Hey guys, thank you for tuning in to the first ever episode of The Wild Wild Web. Every week, I'll be exploring the edges of the digital frontier through in-depth discussions with innovative pioneers and builders in the Web3 space. Just a quick note, nothing you hear in today's episode should be construed as financial or legal advice. I'm truly excited to start this journey with you into the Wild Wild Web, our vibe, our tribe. Well, we're recording. We're live. We'll see what happens. Hey, look at us, man. First episode ever. Wild Wild Web.
I love it. I'm honored.
Are you?
I am, dude. I'm honored. Wild Wild Web, man. Who knows what's going to happen here?
That's true. You just mentioned you were watching Pepe Coin. I just bought into Turbo. So not much has changed since we got back into this wild stuff back in 2017, yeah?
Yeah. It's, it always feels different. It's never the same. I think the meme stuff right now is weird because everybody's still licking their wounds from FTX or NFT dumps or, you know, all the way back 3AC and Luna and all that stuff feels like years ago. So this is, I don't know what's going on. I don't know if like people are just rolling their whole stack into this as like a final hurrah before they leave the industry entirely, but I'm here for it, man. Nice to see some green.
I saw a great tweet on these meme coins and in whatever like little cycle we're in. This is either the end of this is either the end of it all or the start of something beautiful. And I thought that was put really, really, really well. Yeah. So guys, I'm sitting here with Mike Finch. I'm going to let him introduce himself in just a second. Again, you just heard this is the first ever episode of the Wild Wild Web. I'm excited to talk macro markets with Mike, the SEC, the Fed, what he's up to with Parada Capital. We've got a lot of things to talk about. Blur is another thing I'd love to get in with you and its effect on the NFT market as it is today. But yeah, man, I'm just excited to be sitting here with you. Like, we don't really have like weekly conversations, you know, like we're in messages together and, you know, all this stuff, but we don't get to like sit down and have a convo just because we're not in the same area anymore. So it's always good to sit down with you.
Yeah, no doubt, brother, for sure. It's, you know, it's shitty that that's the way that it works, but I guess it's a good thing because that means, you know, things are happening. We're, you know, we got stuff going on. You know, I got a little one now, so it's doing the dad thing a little bit there. But yeah, man, I mean, like I said, honored to be on the first episode. I can give a little bit of background on kind of like how I got into all this if you want. I don't think we've ever done that really.
Yeah. I would love to hear it. So me and Mike obviously worked together at ICO Alert as well. And Mike, I just wanted to, like, we've had this journey together over the last, what, 5 or 6 years, which is wild to say at this point. What was your favorite memory from maybe like the ICO Alert or even just the past 6 years together? Do you have anything that rings a bell?
Man, the Ethos ape that was basically, you know, like six figures into zero was always a good one. Same with the Substratum piece at ICO Alert. Like, ICO Alert was one of the first ICO listing sites that my younger brother started, and I came in to help him scale it. He was the first employee, scaled it into like a real full-on research marketing firm, collected a ton of data. You know, we're even selling that data to hedge funds at one point at the height. There was a coin called Substratum that was going to be the new internet, as many of these come across from time to time in this industry. And we were so deep in it that we were watching like C-SPAN government regulatory internet, you know,
like ISP stuff. Yes.
ISP stuff. Wonder, you know, thinking that this had anything to do with our coin. And yeah. You know, in classic like get wrecked fashion, I think I sold mine for a 10x. I think we got in like 3 cents and it was at 30 some. I was like, all right, this is a good time to exit. And over the next 6 weeks, it went to $3, you know?
Yeah.
So those stories always center around like big wins or big losses, which, you know, certainly kind of like have those across the 6 year period and even beforehand.
Do any of those moments with Substratum or ETHORSE or your time in this in previous cycles rhyme with what's happening right now? You know, a lot of people are experiencing meme for the first time, the shitcoin season, quote unquote, for the first time. What rhymes to you from the time where you were buying Substratum and it was going up, you know, 10x to 100x, and now you're seeing Pepe in the top 30 on CoinMarketCap?
Yeah, I don't think that moment in particular rhymes quite yet. I think we're headed there. This time feels, I was almost said different, but I, you know, this time definitely doesn't feel different. This reminds me of like summer 2020, maybe late summer 2020. So we DeFi? Had the big COVID. Was that DeFi? Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah, I can't remember. It was either 19 or 20, but it's a parallel to me because of the COVID crash and the FTX crash. Like I got crushed in COVID. Got crushed in FTX, right? As did many in the industry. Not as bad as COVID, but still bad. You stick around long enough here, you're going to get wrecked. Just is what it is. That's how it works. So I kind of use those two really big moments, those big like open interest wipes, huge price depressions, huge bearish events where basically everybody looks, myself included, and says, hey, with current evidence, this market's not coming back for 18 months, man, right? And then you kind of fast forward in COVID times to like the Fed printing a bunch of money, similar to what you're seeing now with the banking crisis, albeit, you know, quite a bit different. And it still seems to me, as we saw in January with that initial kind of like early year pump out of the, you know, from the absolute bottom, that max pain for most people is still just straight up. It's not to say that's what it will do, but crypto does tend to do things that make people angry, like we were saying at the beginning of this. So I think that's a decent parallel right now. That's the hopium anyway, right? Otherwise, we're like early 2019, and we still have another 12 to 18 months before any hope. And this is just a pure bull trap, and Bitcoin's going to go back to 20 or under 20 or whatever, recession, blah blah blah. Right. All the FUD that's being kicked around.
Yeah. Obviously those are like two competing narratives, right? Like what side do you lean on in the bull trap, or we're actually like seeing some actual growth here, in markets and liquidity and all that stuff.
So for me, like I'm probably more of a trader, or what I would call like a medium to long-term investor, than I am just a pure holder. Pure holders always do the best. Like props to guys like my brother Rob and others who are able to just, you know, faithfully believe in this stuff no matter what and never sell it, right? Holders will always do best there. The trick with holders is that you have to be right. If you're wrong, you're wrong, you're done, right? You can hold it to 100 and hold it to zero and completely round trip your position there. So you've got to be right. But when you're right, that's where you perform the best. I do well with like longer term swing trading. So like cycle to cycle stuff, trying to understand when a bottom is in and when a top is close. And then from there, stock picking on crypto versus other assets like stocks. And then within crypto specifically, which one of those majors or those like top 100, top 200, top 300 coins, you know, whether or not they've been released or not, you know, which one of those are going to kind of perform. And obviously over the last 4 years now, since we started Parada, we've been able to learn a lot. Every year has taught us something different. We really feel like we understand market structure and where the opportunities are and who the main players are and how liquidity flows in and out of this market. So it's a lot more than just kind of like, you know, a shotgun approach and buying 100 coins and hoping you get like 100 or 1,000x out of it. You know, concentration builds wealth and diversity keeps it. So alongside all of this, you know, you have expenses, you have bills, you have things you want to do with the family or whatever. So there's a maintenance there that's required too. And, you know, kind of like two parallel paths. So just as like some background as to kind of like what works for me, typically I make money on being long, right? Like I don't make that much money being short. If I'm typically if I'm short, it's as a hedge, right? So be it like puts in the options market or pair trading or something like that, where you might long ETH, short Bitcoin, something like that. And basically that's just used to lower your exposure on the downside if you're wrong. Obviously you don't get as much on the upside either, but you know, if you're right on that front, you still kind of win. So that's typically the only time that I'm short personally, or we're short with the fund. So a little bias there in that, like, hey,
Yeah.
when number go up, we make money, right? And I think that's how it works for most people. With that being said, like, again, I do see a lot of parallels to the post-COVID environment. You know, we'll get into that on the macro front with the Fed and kind of the position they're in from a you know, a super macro pleb in me. But then on the crypto front, like, you have seen that big wipeout. You do have basically like 1 to 5% of the people left who were here 2 years ago, right? Who thought this was kind of like, this was it, super cycle, blah, blah, blah. And most importantly, I think you have on the back of the macro scene, what could potentially be the strongest narrative ever for Bitcoin, for ETH individually, and for crypto as a whole. So, I'm pretty bullish, man. I'm pretty bullish.
Love to hear
It's
it.
this will be my third cycle coming up. You know, ICO alert was the first one. They say in your first cycle, if you make it, it's just pure luck, right? And that's how it was with me. I was like, I got in late 2015, early 16. Thought I could just trade Bitcoin and make money, and that was, you know, I'd just retire. And that was it. As I
At
slammed,
25.
as I slammed bids on, buys and sells on Coinbase, like eating fees, like I ate them for breakfast or whatnot. And then found ETH and and basically was like, hey, there's something here. Let's just roll it all into ETH. That was like late 2016 timeframe, maybe. It was post DAO hack, obviously. So we're like 10 to 20 buck area there. Rode that up, ICO alert era. Obviously ICOs were, the hot girl at the dance, hot guy at the dance at the time. So EOS was the big one. We had followed that from way pre-announcement and basically rolled everything into that. And at the end of that cycle, like I said, just got lucky to basically say, hey, like 99% of my net worth is in this shit. Like I
Yeah.
need to take some profit,
You know, one thing I try to analogize for people in the NFT space is this is going to be the second cycle now, if there is one for NFTs. And the question is always, you know, is it going to get back to where it was? And I think the answer that I have for people is based on my experience in ICOs, whether that's bias or not, is that there were tokens that did extremely well in the ICO cycle that came back and did even better afterwards. There are a lot like EOS that never got back to former glory. And that's the same thing I think that's going to happen in NFTs. And I use that analogy. I don't know if you kind of buy into that either, but it is going to be something where NFT blue chips, quote unquote, some won't come back even if there is another NFT cycle.
100%, right? It's like I was saying before about holding, right? Whether it's coins, NFTs, stocks, real estate, whatever it is, right? Like if you're a person who's gonna hold EOS or Feathercoin or Rise or Substratum or any of these, right? Like if you believe in it, like to some degree, you've got to stick with your gut, right? You've got to stick with what you've hopefully learned in your experience, but you have to be right, because if you're not right, you're going to miss out on whenever the next niche is within crypto, or whatever the next opportunity is, kind of waiting and hoping that this specific asset or this specific niche as a whole within crypto is going to take off. So
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, like Chainlink, right? Chainlink was an ICO, pretty sure. And it's like the backbone of DeFi in a lot of ways. So some like a lot of the NFTs will still exist. I think NFTs will very much be around, but I don't think it will look exactly like it looked last time, because everybody's aware of NFTs now, right? Like your mom, your dad, your uncle, your brother, they all, like, people know what it is, right? And the same dynamics don't exist now that that's the case. So anyway, like that was, yep, that was first cycle. Second cycle was the one that we had, and they say second cycle is like, you know more, so therefore you kind of screw it up, right? Like you don't get as much of the like left side of the curve, low IQ luck that you got in the first one. You know, and like took great profit in the second cycle, but in a lot of ways that didn't stick to the initial trading plan, screwed it up in a lot of different ways. And, you know, like the trough from cycle to cycle was higher, as was the peak, which is always a win, but like you always look back, like we said, at some of these mistakes you made, like aping at the end of the cycle into ETHorse ICO, mm-hmm, or aping into Doodles at the end of the cycle, right? Like whatever it is. And those mistakes will continue to be made. So third cycle, they say, though, that's when like you really make the money, because okay, you've learned the lessons. you know, that you don't need kind of luck as much on your side anymore. It always helps, right? Always better to be lucky than smart. But that's the hope now, right? Is like that this time you really know what you're doing. You've spent the time kind of doing the research and putting yourself in a position where you're going to be able to thrive in another similar event. So I'm in this weird position where like psychologically I have immense amounts of PTSD from getting wrecked in FTX or whatever it may be. It's very hard to switch your mind from the bear market setting where all you've seen is red to the bull market setting where literally you just don't think, you just follow narratives, you follow niches, you ape into the memes. But a lot of people get caught up with that and they miss out, and then they FOMO, and you know, they buy the top and it dips for a couple months and they're out, and then it pumps again, and you end up getting chopped up at the trend change. Yeah. So that's the battle that I'm going through, is like everything that I follow on the coin side of things, like on-chain indicators, everything says the bottom's in, and that while we're not surely going to go straight to all-time highs, they like largely now is the time, and has been the time for the last probably 2 months or so to really start, you know, getting some exposure back on the coin front. Mm-hmm. All of those things, like fundamental or tech, like I don't use a lot of technical analysis, but like largely the fundamental stuff, the on-chain stuff, you have to listen to that. You have to stick with your trading strategy, even though your brain is saying like, don't fuck this up again, because if you mm-hmm. do, like, that's it. You know,
do you outsource your technical analysis to Dimitri?
I used to, yeah. And then, you know, I think he retired. He quit for greener pastures. He's living on some island somewhere after Dimitri's desk. But it's just never been my thing.
I had this conversation with my co-founder at Web3, Gifted, about the opportunity cost of living in this space, right? Like my anxiety actually is worse when I sell and have to watch something potentially, you know, go 100x, as opposed to maybe, you know, losing out, you know, on, you know, ETH or what have you, taking the negative side of that. But there is opportunity cost at every turn. Like if you look back with 2020 vision in this space, you'll go absolutely insane, because you could have been a trillionaire, a billionaire. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like there's so many opportunities for potential unicorns that you can go mad. And one of the big things that I took away from something you said early on was really in this space, the only rule is survival, and bridging to each cycle is your main priority. Because if you can do that, and then you can place yourself at the front of whatever the new, you know, cycle is, then you'll likely do well. So,
yeah, 100%, man. I mean, like, that's what all of the OGs from 2010, 2011, 2012 say who are still here. Survival is key. And it's funny you say that, like, all these opportunities, don't want to miss out. And like a lot of people are thinking that right now with Pepe. because the community is super small right now. Be it your like Discord groups or Telegram chats or even just what you see on Twitter, right? Like Pepe started popping up, what, like 2, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago? And a lot of people are going to look back and instead of looking at it in like the like diligent kind of strict disciplined way and saying, hey, I missed this opportunity, but this is a good sign because this typically means that there is more to come. People will FOMO in and lose all of that buying power before seeing the next opportunities. So the best trader, like, let's be honest, right? Like nobody's holding Pepe for 5 years because they think it's the next amazing asset, right? Like this is purely a trade. You're purely trying to take dollars or ETH and turn them into more. These are incredibly difficult because of that psychological battle, right? How many thousands of people, 2x or 3x or 5x this from like 7 zeros to 6 zeros, and now we're at 5 zeros, and it's like, oh my God, I could have had $5 million. That would have been it, right?
Yep.
So you beat yourself up over and over again. And as long as you can survive and as long as you can kind of take a step back, I think, and try to understand, number one, where your skill sets are, number two, where you are in the broader crypto cycle, and then number three, figure out some structure or game plan to try to keep track of and discover what those new opportunities, those new niches in crypto, right? Like what's the next DeFi? What's the next NFTs, right? Like who are the people that you need to get close to in order to hear about this stuff and learn about this stuff before it's the number one trending coin on CoinMarketCap? Because at that point, it's too late. If it's going to take you 4 or 5 days, whether you're doing it full-time or part-time, a week, whatever, to understand this, the move's already done.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah, you could get into Pepe here and get like a 2 or 3X, but from a risk reward standpoint, it's kind of a terrible trade because this could do minus 90% at any time.
Yeah. I love that you brought that up. Let's have a little bit more talk here on Pepe, but before that, since we're 23 minutes into the episode, why don't we just give them your bio real quick or give them what you're up to with Parada? I know you founded Parada in 2018, I believe. Correct?
2019. Yep.
2019. You know, kind of give me the initial thesis there with that portfolio and also what you guys are up to today.
Yeah, definitely. So like before all of this, I was in craft beer. I come from a sales and relationship management standpoint. Graduated, got lucky that my older brother decided to start a craft brewery, like ironically kind of towards the end of that wave. He caught like the last 3 or 4 years. So I got thrown in the deep end from a sales and a business standpoint. And that's where a lot of my skills lie. Towards the end of that, my younger brother, Rob, who's the original ideator behind ICO Alert, started talking to me more about crypto, and I started getting into it. And like I said, kind of spent some time just buying and selling Bitcoin back and forth, largely losing money or breaking even in 2016. And slow, you know, got into the Ethereum ecosystem at a time when it was really depressed. And then obviously kind of found the ICO opportunity where we started ICO Alert. So I was able to come in with the skills that I already had and help scale that business while at the same time learning over the last, you know, like let's say 2016 to 2018, over the last 2 years, like how does all this crypto stuff work, right? Like who are the main players, blah, blah, blah. All from a purely business standpoint, right? With the skills and the understanding that I had, really less so a trading standpoint or kind of like the financial markets standpoint. I don't have any background there. My major was in psychology, right? And before the brewery got launched, I was going to do real estate. So a lot of it was just kind of like using those skills to put myself in a position where I could like take advantage of an opportunity and help out on that front with my skills. But towards the end of that run, like fall 2018, you know, I kind of like really looking back, knew that I wanted to remain in the space, but also knew that like the crypto business, like running a business in crypto, as I had done for the last year and a half or whatever was so difficult because the highs were so high and the lows were so low, and it was so hyper cyclical that you had to, in a lot of ways, do everything right from a fundraising standpoint or execution standpoint or whatnot. And as we saw with ICO Alert, like in a period of 9-10 months, your entire business model can just be worthless, regardless of how well you do. So decided to basically go back and go back to what had kind of gotten me to the dance, which was stock picking in a lot of ways. But I, you know, wanted to kind of create a brand from it, create a business from it. So decided to, you know, basically self-fund the hedge fund, put a brand behind it, and get in and really start to learn a lot about how the markets work, right? Good at the stock picking, good at kind of understanding, hey, here's a narrative. These are the top performers in this narrative or the niche, this niche. This is going to be valuable to a lot of other people, and therefore they're going to want to buy it. But you need a lot more than that to exist in this market 24/7. So I knew I needed like a lot more of the basic, you know, financial trading aspects, and had met my business partner probably 6 months or so earlier, who was in a similar position, you know, kind of looking for the next opportunity. So we joined up, launched the fund, you know, basically went out in 2019 and got to learning. We were down that year for sure, maybe like minus 12% or something like that. Finally got to a point where we felt like, you know, we were doing pretty well. We could handle ourselves in the market. Certainly didn't know nearly as much as we do today. And then the COVID crash hit. So, you know, about a year after we started the fund, COVID crash happened in March 2020, wiped out everything, put me in a position where I was basically like, okay, if I want to continue with this business and not go and get a normal job, I need to like move everything to cash and lower my exposure in a major way. Like we were pretty much 100% long at the time the COVID crash happened. And that happened in, yeah, that happened in a period of, you know, 4 or 5 days fully. So there, you know, and we didn't really have like a lot of the access or intelligence to know like how to short it or why to short it or anything like that yet. So it was a pretty big wipe. But decided to kind of keep with it, right? Sell all the coin at the bottom. It's basically what I did, and continue. And from there we found like the market was completely broken, just like it was after FTX. So really thanks to my business partner, we're able to find some good arbitrage opportunities between two different options platforms where basically market makers had been blown out. So you could sit on one options platform and buy on this one and sell on this one, and then you just wait for the option to expire, and that would net you out the difference. So we were able to profit quickly in that, you know, hellish kind of
well one period. good on you guys for being able to, you know, have the stones to say, hey, I need to sell here. You know what I mean? Like some guys probably held even longer than that and took even farther losses. So I do remember the Black Thursday, I believe.
Yep.
Having the Framework Ventures guys on that afternoon. Oh, like what, well, these guys, yeah, had to be on. I could imagine now looking back, like why did these guys even show up? Like there's no reason for them to hop on this, like, you know, NFT or Web3 podcast and do that. And they ended up doing it, but they were extremely wrecked, as everybody else was. Can you, in like maybe 30 seconds to 60 seconds, explain what happened with BitMEX that day where they had to like turn off the exchange and why that was potentially life-saving for a lot of what was happening in crypto at the time?
Yeah, I'll do my best to kind of keep it brief here and go back through the memory bank. But the COVID crash was one that like was far crazier than FTX or Luna or any of these, because it was across all financial markets. So every trader, every investor, every person with assets was basically moving whatever they could as fast as they could to cash, crypto included. And you saw the same thing happening in the crypto market. So this was basically the futures markets breaking. Futures markets from BitMEX basically being defined by their perps, their perpetuals, which are futures that never close. So traditionally, like a futures contract would close at a certain date. This one never closed. So what you have to do as an exchange then is you have to make sure that those who are long or those who are short are relatively even on the book, so that you don't put yourself in a position where you have more that are short than long, and you're unable to facilitate the marketplace because you don't have enough like buy side folks or buyers to fill all of the short that has now made a bunch of money if the market went down. And that's like kind of broadly, it's like kind of like a 70 IQ take there on what happened. But basically, BitMEX got into a position where the price was moving so fast down at a time when, you know, basically the middle of the night, Eastern time, middle of the night, Eastern time, when markets were highly illiquid. And there was something like $15 million left between $3,800 per Bitcoin and $0 per Bitcoin. BitMEX did have a massive insurance fund of Bitcoin that sits there for this reason. But the conspiracy is that they basically looked at it and said, okay, we have X amount of short interest that needs to be paid out. We have no buyers here. No one is stepping in to buy this, especially not on a futures exchange. Why would you just buy spot, right? There's no chance of liquidation. And we have this insurance fund. What are we going to do? And they made some calculation, in my opinion, and basically said, hey, we need to shut off the exchange here for not just for us, but for Bitcoin as a whole. Because if Bitcoin ever goes and prints $0, that's it. No one will ever believe that it's here to stay. Every chart will be ruined. I don't care that it's a perp, anything else, disaster, right? So I think that's what they did. And you saw like a pretty quick rip from the lows, which was like 3,200, 3,800, whatever, back up to over 4K. And then it spent another week or two in this same kind of range. Might have even gone lower from when they shut it off. And then obviously the rest is kind of history as the Fed came into print and Bitcoin went on a tear again.
Okay, so give me up to today what Parada Capital has been doing. I know we had that like slight little history lesson piece there, but yeah, keep going on where you're at kind of today.
Sure. So 2020, we licked our wounds. We never caught DeFi summer there. You know, if anything, we lost money at the tail end, bought high and sold low, basically what we try not to do. As do most. So licked our wounds, you know, made enough money to kind of like pay ourselves and keep ourselves in business in summer 2020. And then late summer, early fall, did really well in the options markets. You know, we'd spent, again, the last 6 months basically learning how it all worked as we hit this ARB. So we did really well on ETH options there, and had also made a really oversized investment in Dapper Labs at an early stage then. They were running their Series B because of COVID. The terms were the same as Andreessen Horowitz got in Series A, which was like never happens. But it looked like a great opportunity. And like looking back on it now, obviously glad I did it, but it was like a good example of, even though had gotten crushed, like stick to the trading plan, which was assets are super depressed here. Everybody thinks this is over. This is where you buy. So put more money than I should have into that. That ended up, you know, the Flow token ended up doing really well. That was like largely our big hit last cycle. Completely missed the NFT run. If anything, did the same as I did with DeFi and bought like the top, or at least this time I like bought on the first dip and was like, hey, this is it. This is the first dip. This is where you buy. Then it dipped like 12 more times after that. And you know, basically held the bags more or less all the way down. But you know, harvested some tax losses there and have basically done exactly the same thing I did from cycle one to cycle two as I have now from cycle two to hopefully what is cycle three, which is basically like done enough to survive, not 100% fucked it up. You know, like I think net worth high watermark cycle one to cycle two was down 93%, just like your favorite shitcoin. And then cycle two to now was down like 88%. So I've improved by 5%. Still as equally painful, as equally painful, you know, maybe slightly better. But, you know, largely what Parata does today, or even before that, right? Like we knew going into 2020 before the COVID crash that what we excelled at was basically a barbell-based approach where we go out in the futures market or the options market and we earn yield in some way. This is typically market neutral or delta neutral yield, which means the price goes up or down, doesn't affect us. And the yield is maybe only like somewhere between 15 and 25% or 10 and 20%, you know, over a period of a year across multiple market conditions. But then what we do is we take a portion of that yield and we pay ourselves for expenses, and we take the other portion of the yield and we roll it into your like high risk, high reward bets, like your venture ones and things like this.
So,
So,
when you're talking about yield in this barbell approach, are you talking specifically on ETH as an asset, or what assets are yield generating that you guys are actually like participating in?
you can do it a variety of different ways. I think you kind of, well, they all kind of, because crypto is so cyclical, have to work across those cycles to be effective. ETH is ETH or any other staking coins is a great example where what, like in a perfect world, what you would want to do is you would want to buy those assets, like the print, use your principal to buy those assets when they're down bad, super depressed, and then you would start staking them, right? You're earning anywhere from 5 to 25% staking rewards. Maybe you're peeling off some of those staking rewards for expenses and you're selling them to cash, but ideally you're holding them for as long as you can. Because you, the thought is, right, the trading plan is that not only your principal eventually will be much higher than it is today, assuming you're picking the correct assets, but also the staking rewards. So you're locking in long-term capital gains instead of short-term capital gains if you're in a jurisdiction where you're taxed. You're buying the bottom and hopefully selling the top. But then further, what you can do with the staking rewards or the principal amount that's being staked is that in the futures market, you can go to those perpetual contracts and with enough margin, or ideally in kind, you take those assets and you deposit them on the exchange and you short the equal amount. If you're doing that, if you're depositing them to the exchange, you're taking counterparty risk with the exchange, and you're no longer earning the staking reward. But if you're somewhere near like a frothy environment, you're going to get paid massively in what's called a funding rate, which is basically when conditions are very frothy. If you're short, you get paid to be short. At the height, you could make 85% a year doing this. That might only last for a month. That APY might only last for a month. But across that year, across, say, 2021, you could earn 40, 45%. While you hopefully shorted the asset towards the top and are now holding that $30 flow price or that $20 Atom price or that, you know, $10 EOS price, whatever it is, right? $3,000 ETH price and earning the staking reward. So that's just one example of a way to do it. And you can overlay that in similar ways across DeFi, across the options markets. You can now today do that in NFTs in a lot of ways. We don't do that really, but I know people certainly do. And then even further, you can, if you really take the time and you spend the years to learn and get good at it and take the losses, then you can actually do it like and work all the markets in together so that your positions in the options markets are earning yield and helping your positions in the futures market, which are earning yield. And you can move it based on kind of that yield and the broader cycles. And you know, it's a lot of finesse.
So obviously nothing that we're saying is financial advice. I'm sure I'll add the disclaimer in at the beginning of the episode, but for those people who maybe aren't as financially experienced or financially as experienced, is something like ETH staking, the best way to go for those folks? Like I'm looking at maybe instead of like trying to, take multiple
Sure.
sides of a position and gain yield that way. I'm sure there are people that like are going to take exactly what you were just talking about and be like, that's what I'm going to do. Again, not financial advice or anything like that, but for those people who are maybe less experienced, what's the easiest way for them to approach the market when it comes to yield?
Yeah, I mean, largely like getting into crypto and trying to go from a part-time to a full-time standpoint is probably the most difficult part about crypto because it's so hypercyclical. Typically, you're only able to do that at the top. So you leave your job, whatever, at the top when prices are high. You're staking your ETH's worth. Let's say it's a year, a year, 18 months from now, ETH's worth like 12 grand. Right, you're like, I'm a fucking genius. Look at this, right? I'm earning 5% on all this ETH I have. It's at 12K. And then typically what happens is most people get bled out over the next 2 years and they lose all of the buying power that they have then, when really they should do the unsexy thing, the non-sexy thing, and keep the job, sell a majority of their assets, right, into cash, put it into safer markets and wait for the next opportunity. Again, this is purely if you're trying to like trade this on a medium to long-term time frame, like anywhere from 12 to 36 months, right? If you want to be the person who if you're a pure holder, right, and you got into ETH at 10 bucks or 20 bucks or 100 bucks or even here, right, you just want to hold it, assuming you're picking the right asset, that will generate you the most return just by purely holding it. However, you're not really making any income. Like, yeah, you make some staking income, but likely it's not enough to live off of. So in order to do best within this market, you have to have the income coming in so that you don't put yourself in a position where you're a forced seller, which is basically where assets are super depressed in price. You're still holding those assets from the top or from close to the top. There's now no reasonable route for any sort of revenue on top of these for at least 6 months because of some event like COVID or FTX that has happened. And you have to basically sit back and say, well, hey, if I want to eat or pay rent or pay my mortgage or whatever, like I have to sell these assets. There's nothing you can do. You are a forced seller. So I think typically with this stuff, unless you really want to go down the mental anguish pathway of trying to trade this market, then just building up slowly and putting yourself in a position where you have the most possible buying power. We can talk about that for all the new opportunities that are coming. That's your best bet. When you start to get fancy, you start to get too short term, you start to pay less attention to the broader narrative, like the fact that banks are failing and Bitcoin isn't, then you do too much and like you just end up kind of screwing it up. Not necessarily because you don't know what you're doing, but because you're doing something at the wrong time.
Yeah, the stream is you're fighting against the stream at the toughest time to do so, essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great way to put it.
So there's an interesting thing going on here in the NFT market, right? And we have a bunch of topics that I want to get to before we wrap up the episode, but Blur and their one, just Blur in general, right? The platform that is essentially now the dominant NFT marketplace, and then their launch of Blend now, which is their lending and borrowing protocol that has already set records for doing the most volume, like ETH volume, overall. And that's with other products being out for more than like a year and a half. It's an interesting dichotomy for me because when we came into the space, the space was purely financial, and that's one of the coolest things about NFTs. And it's one of the things that makes my thesis, not unchanging with NFTs is that they traditionally bring in the culture, the art, the gaming, the
Community.
branding. You're talking about merchandise, you're talking about clothing, all of these things, all these cultural things can be accessed or displayed through NFTs. And that's awesome. And it brings in a lot of people that aren't super financial focused. And what's happening now is those people are like, what is Blur doing?
Sure.
Blend and Blur and their hyper financialization of our industry is kind of destroying the ethos of what we thought this was. So I know you come from a more, you know, trader background. I'm interested in your take on one, Blur, and the Blur token, but also their launch of other financial products into the NFT space.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think the backlash is largely like exactly what you said, in that NFTs came about and are attractive to most as collectibles first, right? As culture, as something that you would look at within the crypto space, similar to like nice clothes or a nice car or something like this, outside of the crypto space. Now, the problem with that, and I think what people who have gone through the NFT cycle once are learning now in an NFT bear market, is that the collectible and, you know, the collectible aspects, the showcasing aspects, the flexing of NFTs, right, is a bull market phenomenon, in the same way that altcoins really only move in a bull market phenomenon. They move for different reasons, but what you need is you need that outsized profit and you need those good times for people to want to go in and improve their profile picture, or for somebody to build a digital art collection. Now, all of this doesn't mean that none of this is going to be valuable 10 years from now. I think the technology behind NFTs, just like blockchain technology as a whole, is super valuable, and there will be a place for NFT technology in the future. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the cycle change that you see with NFTs. In the bull market, it's all about collecting. If you have the assets, the NFT assets that the most people want, you're going to get the best price for them. Just like if you're able to buy the cheapest alts right now and they end up being like one of the best performers in the next bull cycle, you're going to get an insane multiple on those, right? If you can pick the best NFT or coin or whatever, and you hit, right? But right now is a trader's market. No one has the money to come in and spend 200 ETH on a Fidenza, which is why Fidenzas are 50 ETH. Nobody has 150 ETH to spend on a rare Bored Ape, which is why it's a 50 ETH floor. So what you have is you have a market that's dominated by traders who have liquidity, unlike those NFT collectors who don't have liquidity. Many NFT collectors are looking at their first crypto cycle and saying all the same things that we talked about. Why did I screw this up? I should have taken profit. You know, I got drunk on my own Kool-Aid, blah, 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 right? Everybody makes the same mistake. You have to get wrecked. You just have to go through it. Everybody has before you. It is what it is. But point of the story is that NFTs are a trader's market right now. That's why Blur is dominating. OpenSea is a very aesthetic platform. You know, it doesn't always work. It's not always 100% sexy, but like, if you just want to go and look at art or PFPs or whatever, it's a great platform for that. Like Blur doesn't really have that because their focus is purely for traders. Now, a symptom of that is that the really big whales in NFTs now have liquidity. So you see a lot of these guys coming in and thinking like, oh, I know how to pick the right assets. I made hundreds or thousands of ETH over the last cycle. Now I'll just trade them and make more, and I'll be in an even better position from, you know, for the next bull market from where I am now. So you kind of have like traders and people who don't care about the collection and aesthetic aspects of this coming in and taking advantage of those who either one need liquidity for bills and expenses and whatnot, right? They become forced sellers to some degree. And then two, those who did really well, who think they're traders and, you know, their shit smells like roses, right? And I think really that's a lot of what you have with Blur. Blur has become this marketplace for the sharks to feed on each other because there's no real new buy demand in NFTs. You have a lot of people swapping out, you know, from the projects that haven't done well to the projects that have held up, or from the art that hasn't done well to, you know, like sell it all and just buy one blue chip kind of thing, right? So I think broadly that's what you get with Blur, and that's why they've dominated, because that's who the user base is right now.
My biggest defense of Blur has been the fact that So you see these downward spirals of in price action when it comes to the projects that are associated with like the blur farming, right? You see a 70 ETH floor, and then in a matter of a couple weeks, maybe, and I might even be, given some rope there on that project's price goes down significantly. And I think my biggest defense of blur is saying it's not necessarily blur that's making the price go from 70 to 50. It's just catalyzing that effect on a deeper level. And my point is, like, it's probably just catalyzing all of this to get to levels where that we don't want it to be seen. But I feel like most people are saying, hey, look, the floor prices are falling. It's Blur's fault. Is there an element to that that is true with the sharks kind of eating each other and dipping the price? I guess, is that legitimate?
It is to some degree. I don't think you can blame Blur because in the crypto markets, in capitalism as a whole, if there's an opportunity to make money, people are going to come in and make money. That's what Blur has done. But all Blur is doing is providing a place for people to come in and host liquidity, right? The illiquidity, the lack of liquidity within NFTs during a bull market is not a bug, it's a feature. Right, that's why they pump so hard, is because there's so few of them. And with OpenSea before Blur, it was very difficult to buy a lot at one time. You couldn't just come in and, like, as apes were going up, you couldn't just come in and buy 50 apes at 30 ETH as a whale. Like, you might get an average price of 42 because you and a handful of others pumped it from 30 to 50, right? But that for holders is a feature then. Illiquidity right now for holders is a bug because it's very difficult to find people who are looking at last cycle NFTs who think that this is the best place to be for the next month, the next 3 months, the next 6 months, the next year, right? So, like, the allure of taking your ETH and turning it into a profile picture or an awesome piece of art that you like is now gone because all of those marginal buyers have been wrecked by Celsius and BlockFi and 3AC and Luna and FTX and general mistakes. Like, the amount of opportunities for the market to screw you over was higher in 2022 than I experienced all years prior. I mean, it was absurd,
Probably
right?
combined.
But yeah, exactly, right? Like, combined all years is my point. There's not been a year with more landmines than 2022. So first off, if you're still here, like, congratulations, because you are part of the 1% from the top. Most people left way before you. They probably came in and lost money. They didn't even make money in the first place. So pat yourself on the back there. But I think the realization that people, especially in the NFT space, have to have now is that the trade they're making here is not the same trade that was made when NFTs were being, like, initialized, when they were blooming, right? Now the market matures, just like the DeFi market has matured, right? Like, we saw DeFi summer. DeFi still hasn't moved since, right? Like, yeah, you do have some new or some old DeFi projects that have held up super well. And if you just held that, you're in a position now where you're looking at the market and saying, the banking system is collapsing and I have a huge bag of whatever, right? Aave or Chainlink or whatever. But those people also understand that that's still not the hot commodity. ETH is, Bitcoin is. Because in these cycles, you have the largest number of holders and the largest potential chance for wealth generation, number one within Bitcoin, and now number two within ETH. Number three is probably like Doge or Solana, one of those. So
I was
as
hoping you'd say
those
ape.
So as those, as largely just Bitcoin and ETH, right? Just to keep it simple, Bitcoin and ETH, right? They have the largest number of holders. So as those go up, those holders generate wealth that they're now looking to take some portion of, or if they're a degenerate, take all of, and roll into what they think is the next opportunity. So typically what you see is you see Bitcoin move first on the back of some narrative, like the Fed printing money during COVID or banks are crashing, in this case. And Bitcoin will outperform everything. It will outperform ETH, maybe not as much as it did prior, but I bet it still outperforms ETH. it will destroy altcoins. If you go to an altcoin BTC pair like Aave BTC, that chart is down only. It's brutal, and it will continue to be like that. And ETH is going to do the same thing to NFTs. Now, it's not to say that like some new NFT is going to come out and do really well, right? Like, I'm sure you're going to have that, just like you had with new DeFi coins. But largely, the realization that I think those in the NFT market now have to have in order to not sell the bottom, whether we're there now or not, is that this is a late stage bull cycle investment. Bitcoin's going to pump, ETH's going to pump. Then when you get into the altcoin phase, the NFT phase, that's where you see this. That's where you see all those profits moving in. And I think that's a lot of why you've seen so many whales use Blur. And you've seen Blur come out with different unique ways for these folks to, in this case with Blend, like hold their assets, but pull out a ton of money that they can go and buy ETH with. And hopefully structure this trade that they're making in a way that even if NFTs go down another 50% and you see Bored Apes at 25 and Fidenza's at 25 and everything else, right? Like they're still good because they can top up margin on their loan and blah, 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 right? But I think that is largely what is happening is that all of the highest risk opportunities in crypto have slowly gone down against Bitcoin and ETH in the bear market. It's typically what happens. Everybody mm-hmm. consolidates Bitcoin and ETH. Now what we're seeing is like we're getting closer to like the bottoming of that, I think, where now Bitcoin and ETH are going to go up. And instead of like, say, the dollar value of those NFTs or those altcoins continuing to go down, the dollar value will base. But the value relative to Bitcoin or ETH will continue to go down. As Bitcoin goes up and NFTs stay flat mm-hmm. from a dollar standpoint. So Bitcoin goes from 30K to 50K. ETH goes from 2K to 3K. But your NFT floor is the same.
Yeah.
So you're not losing dollars, but your purchasing power has been super eroded.
If you're looking at an ETH form. Yes.
Exactly. If you're looking at it from more of like a trading form. Now, typically what will happen after this, again, like 18 months from now, 12 months from now, 24 months from now, however long it is that like, if you just hold those assets, and again, if you're right, if you have chosen the right assets, if you're buying more now, if you're holding now, those risky assets, if you're choosing the right ones, will far outperform Bitcoin and ETH. But the psychological fuckery that you're going to go through over the next 12 or 18 or 24 months is that you didn't pick right. And you should have just sold it all into Bitcoin or ETH at the top or somewhere along the way. And typically what will happen with those who haven't gone through this before mm-hmm. is that they'll sell it during this final 6, 12, 18, 24 month
yeah.
period, right? But I do think we're probably at least 12 months away from a market where people are really rolling significant size back into NFT art or into JPEGs or whatnot. And blaming Blur for this while they're facilitating what is happening, and thus, like, you can kind of be correct, they're not the sole reason this is happening. Because mm-hmm. Binance, Coinbase, and everybody else did it for altcoins back in the day, right? Altcoins used to be just on Uniswap. Remember those days? Illiquidity was a feature, right? Because mm-hmm. it was this funky pool, and then eventually they got listed on all the centralized exchanges. And now there's massive liquidity. No, guess what? Nobody wants this anymore because everybody's terrified and they're just moving back to Bitcoin, or they're selling stuff for taxes, or they're, you know, sick of it and throwing their computer against the wall and exiting the market wholly. So mm-hmm. that's where I think we're at. Doesn't mean NFTs are never coming back, but it does mean that you have to be really right in what you're bag holding if you're going to bag hold it here. Mm-hmm. Because if you're not, the risk of you missing the entire next cycle is much higher than just holding a Bitcoin or an ETH or whatnot.
Yeah, that aren't going to miss the next cycle, to be fair. Like those are not, you're not taking that risk. So speaking right. of you know, staying in the NFT conversation, you've mentioned Doodles a couple times. It has been tough to see a project like Doodles, specifically Proof Collective with Moonbirds. These projects are taking full-ass round trips at this point.
Yep.
I mean, the Proof Collective card went to 110 ETH back down to whatever it's sitting at now. And that's tough to see for a lot of people because, to your point, they're not going to have that purchasing power that they could have had if they had sold it for ETH and then right. just even held the ETH and not even USD. They would have, you know, they'd be sitting on way more right now. So I want to break down this NFT conversation. You mentioned Doodles. Moonbirds is another one that comes up in this discussion. Azuki has far outperformed most NFTs in this market. There's a yep. lot of this like push toward Asia that's being mentioned. I know Animoca Brands has been pounding on the table for that, but Azuki and a couple others are kind of tapping in that market. But give me your bull take on some of these, or maybe even bearish take if you do have them. Is Doodles gonna, you know, be one of those projects that makes it from cycle to cycle? Because we know that there's gonna be some that don't. You know, there's even some previously blue chips are not going to really do that well, even when whatever cycle returns. How do you kind of view which NFTs yeah. are going to do well at this point?
I think any NFTs that don't have runway, that haven't raised money, that don't have today a community that's like vividly strong. And I don't mean like a bunch of people just chatting in Discord every day, holding bags together. Like, I mean like
Twitter sentiment.
Yeah, like just a community, meaning like you have a strong team who's executing, who's doing things that is delivering value to the floor price, right? Like the Canpai Pandas is one that I've heard about and you can see in the floor price. Like, it was straight down and it's kind of base now because mm-hmm. the guy that's running it, like, he took it from a rug and it, like, is throwing parties and doing merch and like doing the shit that people want to do, and therefore people want to be a part of it. Right. Mm. But so I think that's the first thing. Right. Because you have to think from a founder standpoint. Right. I'm somebody who, this was my first cycle as a developer or a CEO or whatever, or it was my second cycle or my third cycle in this space. Right. And I'm looking at this and I'm saying, this is fucked. I'm thinking the same way that you are as a holder and saying, I don't want to miss the next cycle. So I need to find a way to transition out of that. And I think that's what you've seen a lot of over the last 6 months. And I think you're going to continue to see that. Because people don't want to be beat up in Discord about floor price constantly all day. So I think that's the first thing. You need runway. You need to have raised money. I think those that have will exist cycle to cycle. So then it just becomes a question of, again, like stock picking, right? Asset picking. Mm-hmm. Who are the ones that have a very, who have any sort of momentum today? Who are those who have any sort of like real, so like momentum, we're seeing like an Azuki, right? They're obviously the leader in that front. Then you have to look and say others who, like Yuga is a good example where it's like, yeah, they've been beaten up over the last 6 months or whatever, 9 months. But there's clearly a plan. They've had their issues, but there's clearly a community there, right? So I think you really just have to kind of like go through those who qualify on the first number of runway and then try to understand like, hey, who's in the best spot to do well in the next cycle. And again, this is just purely in NFTs, not talking ETH or anything else.
Yep.
So I think your Azukis are obviously going to continue to do well. I think Azukis at some point will go up and probably challenge Bored Apes on floor price, assuming all else continues. I think for you guys, another one, the other side is going to be a big one. Like 18 months ago, should have listened to our own advice and basically said the NFT market won't be back till other side launches. Mm-hmm. And instead of listening to our own thesis, we just went out and bought what looked like attractive dips at the time. So I think Yuga has a real opportunity to kind of like regain their blue chip status there, but it might, who knows how long that lasts. It might be a 1 month, 2 month, 3 month, 6 month kind of thing. And then your Yuga community is going to have to look and say, hey, is this something that's going to continue for another 12 months? Or is this the last opportunity to exit before mm-hmm. we get another pump a year from now at, you know, when meme coins are at a 50 bill valuation and ETH at 15K and Bitcoin's over 100K, but like the end, right? The froth, the final 1 month, 3 month, 6 month where everything pumps, and that's kind of it. But you know, Doodles has made a ton of mistakes. I don't see them excelling.
You know,
to be honest, like you can't exist in a speculative market and then come out and decide that you're not a speculative project anymore. Mm-hmm. And their Doodles 2 launch has been a complete disaster.
Dude,
can I
just hop in there? Because like we had this conversation yesterday on NFT Live, and what I can only come to the conclusion at is that the team is from Dapper Labs originally, and Dapper has done this time after time after time of not caring about the speculative price of an initial drop. CryptoKitties, dude, my CryptoKitties have been sitting there for since 2017. They should be provenance assets. Yeah. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like those should have been like, oh my God, to NFTs. Remember when CryptoKitties, dude, they were worthless to some extent in the last cycle. Same thing they did with Top Shot. And they're doing the same thing again with Doodles. But go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off, but that's the conclusion I came to.
100%, man. Like, you know, I was a big Doodles fan. Love the art. Like, we even still have two Doodles together, you and I, that we went in on. But companies who come from what you would call the Web 2 space and try to exist in crypto, again, it makes a lot of sense when everything goes up, because what it looks like is it looks like new users coming into crypto. And even if that doesn't work, as long as you're still there for those who believed in you early and gave you that initial funding in the form of like a mint to do all this and go and raise tens of millions of dollars from somebody, as long as you're there, that community will stick by you. But as soon as you ditch that community because you now no longer need them, like, what do you expect? Like, yeah, Doodles could go and be the greatest clothing brand. Proof could, you know, and Moonbirds, like, they could go and be a huge player in the art scene, but that doesn't mean that the underlying assets are going to do well, right? Like, you see that today in DeFi. DeFi is massive. There are billions of dollars worth of capital locked up in DeFi today in a bear market, like tens of billions even probably. But the DeFi coins themselves have only gone down, like, other than the you know, end of cycle pump that we saw last time, because there's no value accrual. And that's the hardest part for people who want to sit on the fence between Web 2 and crypto and say, hey, I'm going to do everything outside of the community and then bring value back to the community. Works really well in a bull market, and a bear market will show you like what the truth is and whether or not that works. So listen, like, I'm not an NFT guy first, so I can't go through and rattle off my thoughts on every project. But I think as long as you like have some mental model that says that it's honest first. It's incredibly difficult to be objective and honest with your bags. It's incredibly difficult to have a short memory and say, hey, I should have sold a year ago, or I should have sold 2 years ago, or however long it's been, and I didn't. But this is the reality we're in now. This is the amount of capital I have left. These are the best opportunities, or I'm sticking with my initial trading plan. I think I'm in one of those that is going to continue to do well. I think if it's going to take a massive surprise, it's probably not going to happen, right?
Okay.
So have that mental model, like, be disciplined and really understand, really try to like think and understand what potential your NFT has. But, you know, if you're a part of the community, all this is great. It makes you feel good. That's part of the reason that NFTs have been so attractive, is that like you build a real community around it. You meet new people, you find new opportunities. And if that's what you want to hold for, and that's like the full reason you're there, then you've got to basically write off that investment and understand that like, hey, I'm okay holding this to zero because of the people that are here. But I also have to be comfortable with the like 1 grand or 10 grand or 100 grand or $1 million, whatever it is that I have left in this, will slowly underperform everything else for those reasons. So it's every niche within crypto goes through it. I think that's what NFTs are going through. Blur definitely hasn't helped, but I just like caution people to not not think too subjectively and don't stick and hammer yourself too long on the mistakes that you have made or haven't made, because the money to be made is in the future. It's not in the past. It's over, right? You have to really kind of lick your wounds and get back on the horse. Otherwise, you're never going to survive in this industry.
It's a great
You just
take.
have to learn how to have that short memory and move on, because yeah, there will be new opportunities within NFTs, just like there has been in DeFi, everything else.
One thing I've been trying to wrap my head around is with the introduction of these larger brands, what I think is going to happen in NFTs is they're going to move away more and more from this small volume or small supply of NFT assets into higher supply, less valued assets. And I think for a while I was like, well, that kind of sucks because what happens is you lose the opportunity to put in $100 or put in $200 and have it turn into a $50,000 asset. I think
Yeah.
where my blind spot was, as long as there's enough supply and there's enough, I guess, tools to, for example, sweep something in that sense where you can buy 50 of those smaller valued assets and still see, large returns on those assets. I think that's where my mind kind of like was saying, okay, well, there's still going to be opportunities for us that are putting ourselves at the front line of NFTs. Everything's not just going to turn into $10 assets and we're done,
Yeah.
because there's not going to be that $100,000 asset that is kind of the grail that everybody is seeking. You know what I mean? So I think there is still that opportunity, but any last takes on NFTs? Because I want to get your take here on kind of some macro conditions. But yeah, any re response to that or any last thoughts on NFTs?
No, I mean, the only thing I'm really looking at in NFTs right now is AI art. I think the AI narrative is going to be strong. One of the ways that I filter for new interesting projects is I look at all the venture funding that's occurred in crypto. There's a I'll tweet it out after this, thatfinchguy.eth, but there's a great summary that basically lays it all out. So you go through, you look, hey, this project got X amount of money, whatever. I'm way behind. I've only just gotten through January of this year, but everything in January was AI. Everything. So
I
there's going to
remember
be
that.
some sort of AI narrative. It's going to be 99% dog shit, right? Of just like some AI coin that is complete vaporware, and it's going to go up 1,000x, and people are going to make a ton of money, and then it'll go to zero. But the thing, like, I like art. I'm addicted to collecting NFT art at this point. I can look at that objectively and say that's how it is. So any ETH I'm putting into it right now, I'm basically looking and saying, like, unless I'm like just going balls to the wall into like a Fidenza or something, which I'm not going to do, anything that I'm buying for less than an ETH, like, it's safe to say that ETH is gone, right? Like, the chances of this thing 100xing from here are very low. But who knows? Maybe one of them out of the couple dozen that I get do. And it ends up paying for itself. But if not, it's okay. It's cool art. I like it. So I'm basically within the art, I think, that I'm addicted to collecting here. I think the AI art aspect, not only do I like it, like the Reworld
Aesthetic.
by Ruppe Renesto and his life in West America, like a lot of the, like, they're just cool to me. I like the aesthetic, so it's easier to hold. But I do think there is some potential 12, 18, 24 months from now of that seeing something similar to what we saw with the PFPs.
I love that we can go an hour and 14 minutes and talk about the NFT space and the crypto space and whether, we're going up or down or kind of those different fundamentals that we think exist, and we still haven't talked about there being still a war in Ukraine, still
Right.
a macro condition of the Fed and interest rates, also the SEC kind of hanging over everything. So I think in the last 5, 10 minutes here, if you can give me your take on how that stuff impacts, Web3 or crypto here. So I guess we'll start with potentially we saw the interest rate hike, right? 0.25 basis points, and
Yeah, I'd say
what?
let's start with the war and the regulatory aspect, because those are
Okay,
easy. We'll just check those
hit
right
it,
off.
check it off. Let's do it.
So war is not something that anybody can hedge for, right? You can try to account for that, But typically war is actually like, unless we're talking like World War II nuclear war, like the world is ending, obviously. Like everybody's in their bunker with their gold bars and their canned food, right? Which at that point, it's like, if you think that's what's going to happen, then you shouldn't be speculating and betting on that anyway, because there's no world where you're like shorting Bitcoin and you cash out at $500 Bitcoin. Like, no, like the exchanges are down, it's done, the internet's off. So erase that entirely, right? But war, so anything less than that, war-wise, is typically, believe it or not, good for economies. It's good for commodities. It's good, like it's good for oil prices. Who knows what it does to crypto? But in uncertain times, crypto tends to do well. It tends to find a narrative. So the war aspect, like the only way we're hedging against it is like trying to find interesting energy companies who got completely decimated in COVID time and maybe would do well if a war kicks off.
I do want to push back a little bit when the war, kind of kicked off, and on that very short term time frame, crypto feels like a super risk on asset and doesn't do well in that environment. Am I off
Yeah, no,
base
you're
there?
right. Yeah, you're right. But I don't think it's like, I mean, listen, if you're like leverage trading futures or something and war hits, like you're probably going to get liquidated. It just is what it is. Everybody's going to run to cash. Like you're kind of fucked. But if you're just holding and then war hits and this is when you're dumping, it's like, what are we doing? You know what I mean? Like this will solve itself as all things do. And if it doesn't, then we're all dead from nukes and who cares anyway? So like why sell the bet? You know what I mean? The war piece is what it is. It's awful what's happening, obviously. And I sure shit hope it will end it sometime soon and we don't all have to have this kind of like back of mind anxiety that we touch on every time we smoke or go to sleep or whatever. The regulatory piece is a little bit more complex, but for me, having this being the third cycle, like regulatory anymore, from what I've seen in the way that in the speed that regulatory goes, it's become like a Tether truther thing in a lot of ways. Does Tether have issues? Yes, largely, I'm sure even still today, right? But if you spent the last 5 years shorting Tether instead of just longing Bitcoin, like you've lost everything, right? It's still at a dollar. Will Tether fail at some point? I'm sure, right? Like, yeah, great shot. You want to short it right before the next cycle? Go for it. I think it's a terrible trade. And I think the regulatory fear like that is kind of the new Tether trade, right? Where everybody looks and everyone is basically in agreement that, especially in the US, without further regulatory clarity, it will be hard for some number or some fraction of participants on the institutional side to get in. It's going to be hard for crypto businesses to understand what they can and can't do, especially those that are in the exchange business or in the DeFi business, right? But I don't think there's something that the regulators can do at this point of the crypto asset class that will hurt Bitcoin, ETH, or any of the other major crypto assets. Like they've been in court with Ripple for what, like 3 years? Like if you can't take out Ripple, how are you going to take out Solana or ETH or anything?
At this point, to the cycle situation that you're talking about, like that was two cycles ago almost at this point, and they're still kind of doing that, and that's the thing that comes up each time with regulators, is like how far behind and how they can't keep up with the pace of innovation that this industry, sets a standard with.
We saw all the fuckery that happened with ICOs, and it's still coming down today. People are still getting subpoenaed and fines and all this. And this was 6 years ago. Now you've got worthless meme coins pumping, right? That people are going to lose a ton of money on. And in 6 years, some developer in Kazakhstan or whatever will get arrested. And like, Bitcoin will be at 150K and it'll be a bear
So,
market. You know what I mean?
what you're saying is it's mostly irrelevant, but what, give me, break down the relevant piece, right? Because I generally agree with you. Most of it is just like they're never gonna obviously like get their shit together. But what is a relevant piece on the regulatory side that we need to hone in on?
The relevant piece is not the survival of crypto. The relevant piece is the flourishing of crypto. So the relevant piece is if you're a multi-billion dollar fund manager and you're looking at this space and going, why will this outperform or not outperform equities in the next 2 years? One of the dots on your little dot plot, one of the boxes to check on your sheet is regulatory. And it's hard for those people to look and say, hey, if I deploy $1 billion into Bitcoin and ETH here, plus some venture, whatever else I want to do, some quant, whatever, like there is serious risk that they will underperform the S&P 500, or they will underperform their basket of equities and doing the same thing. And that's bad for them. So with regulatory clarity, you get a massive influx of capital. You see the velocity and the speed at which the price of these things can go increase massively. So the regulatory piece to me is less so a concern for bad things and more so hopium for good things that has never come. I think what happens is that regulators, just like politicians, never catch up. I think Gary's done. I think he's completely embarrassed himself. Somebody else will come in and they'll get a hold of, you know, it'll be Republican this time or whatever. They'll come in and they'll get a hold of things. And towards the top of the next cycle, they'll say they have all these plans and they're shutting it all down, and you'll hear the same thing again, right? But inevitably, this will be even stronger. Every hedge fund in the world will have exposure. You'll have, you know, you'll have interesting new mutual funds. Maybe, you know, maybe we still don't even have a spot ETF, right? But the growth, crypto's growth is far faster than regulators' ability to curtail it. And if people want to own the asset, they will own the asset. Mm. Maybe they just own Coinbase stock. Maybe they just own MicroStrategy. There's money flowing to whatever those businesses or schemes or investment products are. And I think we're at the beginning of that exponential effect, be it with like small, medium, large size hedge funds, your pension funds, your mutual funds. Probably doesn't happen this cycle, but central banks at some point, right? You know, at some point you kind of jump off the fiat ship and look for better stores of value. So regulatory to me is like, if you're not buying crypto because you're worried regulators could kill it, then you shouldn't own any assets, because regulators can kill anything. You shouldn't own any AI, you shouldn't own any biotech, no S&P, nothing else. Just own gold and little dollars, right?
Okay. All right, last topic here, because we do have to close the episode out. This first ever episode here on the Wild Wild Web, we are talking the Fed. So you're talking interest rates. We just saw, again, the interest rate hike for, I think it was like the 10th time in a row at this point, going back to levels, 2008 levels, I believe. That's the last thing I saw. Just give me a take for, you know, maybe the more experienced people, but also if you can dumb it down for us noobs, what it all means.
Yeah. I mean, listen, right, I'm not a macro guy. I don't come from a trading background or a finance background. Like I said, I majored in psych, right? So this is just purely what I've learned from those who know what they're doing, or just from my own experience in markets over the last 4 years. Broadly, every few years since 2018, the Fed has tried to curtail the amount of money that is flowing into the market in one way or another. They tried in 2018, it did not go well, so they stopped. COVID hit in 2020, and they were forced, and rightfully so, I think, injected a ton of money into the economy. That potentially, like, nobody really knows what causes inflation, but a lot of people think it was the Fed's fault. That, along with all the supply and demand issues that we still see today in a world that is going from highly globalized to not highly globalized very quickly because of COVID, you have massive supply and demand issues that also increase inflation. So for the past 2 years, the Fed has been Fed has been in a position where the largest issue politically has been inflation, and the largest issue from a monetary policy standpoint, has been inflation. So they've tried to curtail that after basically telling banks that they do not expect to raise rates. So they've been doing that for a while. They've been doing that quicker. They've been raising rates faster than they have in a long time. And they've basically put themselves in a position now where, like history, nobody believes that they will continue to raise rates and continue to destroy asset markets in the economy. The parallel problem that the Fed has as a, what they would call themselves is like a stabilizer of the price of things, is that the debt to GDP ratio in the US is a complete disaster. It continues to get worse. And a lot of that is because of money printing. So if GDP goes down and inflation is high, you're not able to really return any real rate of return in the US, right? Like at a very high level, broad level. If GDP is growing by 2% and inflation's 4%, then that's minus 2%, right? Like there's no growth there. So what the Fed has basically been doing with all of their debt interest payments, and now with the difference in a, you know, basically like a real rate, has they've been printing themselves back to even. So they're battling inflation, and they're battling like multi-year, not multi-decade problems, in an effort to fix a multi-decade problem. And you have some in some camps who believe the Fed will not quit and they'll break everything in order to try to fix this. And you have others in other camps who believe that the Fed is stuck, especially now, right? Which is my view. If banks weren't collapsing, well, it's like almost daily now at this point, it's definitely weekly. Which, oh, by the way, like the Fed was created by the banking industry. I find it hard to believe that in a post-COVID world where inflation has largely peaked, like I think most people would agree that inflation has peaked, that the Fed will continue to raise rates, even though they know the indicators they use are ones that are lagging, right? So all the data they have today is a year old. And they've been raising rates for, what, 18 months, right? I find it very difficult to believe that 2 years from now, we're going to find ourselves at 7% interest rates or 9% interest rates or 11% interest rates, and Bitcoin will be worth $8,000 and the S&P won't be at new all-time highs. Because history shows that the position that all fiat regimes are in is one that they can't get out of. It's a debt spiral. The difficulty in investing around the Fed and like basically admitting that it's all one trade right now, whether you're buying stocks, crypto, real estate, anything else, just all, it will go up as liquidity enters the system and it will go down as liquidity exits the system. And the Fed is the main proprietor of liquidity. So theoretically, it's all one trade. When the Fed flips and they pause, and then inevitably when they pivot, assets will moon. And we're going to be in this rubber band effect until
forever,
until the system either collapses and we fix it and adopt a new one, or until they figure out some solution to fix all of the debt that they are forced to pay interest payments on.
It almost feels like you need a hard reset, but the problem with doing a hard reset is like that's anarchy, right? Especially for the people that have all the money now, right? Like if there's some type of situation where you have to reset monetary policy or some situation that calls for it, the people that are currently in power and the people with all the money are the ones mostly affected.
So. Yeah. And I get it. Right. Like folks, not in the top 1%, right. Or 1% of the 1%, right. Those not in power, those who are struggling for any which way, or who, let's just even say within crypto, right. Like there's a big, once you get wrecked and you're no longer in a position where you have that buying power, the sexiest thing to happen and the best thing to happen for you is that everybody else gets wrecked just like you. Mm-hmm. And now you're able to buy assets with them at a cheap price. It's very difficult to admit that like the market can move on without you. So doomer porn and doom porn on the timeline is always high because there's always people who their most, like their highest expected value trade is for everything to go to zero.
Blow up.
To blow up, right?
Yeah.
Because then they take their $1,000 or $10,000, $1 million, and they buy a block of real estate in New York for $1 million. And then society slowly rebuilds, right? But it's, again, it's not a trade that I'm interested in making because I don't think it's a trade that ever happens. I think portions of the system will break and will continue to break and will hopefully slowly get fixed, but probably will just like be band-aided and then create a problem elsewhere.
Yeah.
Just like we saw with COVID in 2008 and the banking crisis that we're in now. So to me, I look at crypto and I say, I have no idea when this market's going to be back. Will it be back this year? Will it be back next year? Will it not be back till 2030? This is the 2000s, you know, tech bubble burst and we're just all fucked and we don't know it yet. Cause it's 2001 and a half or 2002, right? Like who knows, but when you input the macro layer and you filter everything through that, more and more, especially since this banking crisis has started, what I see is the need to own assets, hard assets, assets that do not necessarily have the ability to inflate in any way, right? So like Bitcoin is obviously the main driver there, ETH another one. Equities are a big one. American equities will see the most capital flows like until the end of time, unless crypto overtakes them one day. There's always going to be opportunity there. I don't really, like because of having gone through the bear market in 18 and 19 and a portion of 20, I don't really believe the FUD that we see today and that like a recession is coming and earnings are screwed and all these companies like, you know, credit's done and the Fed is going to keep hiking, right? Like it's just for my brain, it doesn't make sense. There's a lot of super smart people who think that's going to happen. And that's kind of the, you know, this whole scenario is the tricky part about identifying trend change because trend change is never clean. It's like, yeah, you look back on COVID and you're like, oh, well, of course the Fed printed a ton of money. It's so obvious.
Yeah.
Well, no, we all thought the world was going to end. We thought there was going to be zombies, all these things. So
it's that 70 IQ bell curve again that you're talking about. Like the people who are trying to say, "Hey, this looks like you know that this is going to get bad." It's like no, like if you actually think about it, they're just going to you know continue doing the same thing that they've been trying to do for you know hundreds of years, but more so in the you know last 50.
I think it's important to remember too that markets inherently are forward looking, right? They're pricing something today based on the future value tomorrow, 6 months from now, a year from now, whatever, right? Which I think is largely why you haven't seen stocks go back and retest lows. We saw the S&P at like 3,500 or something, hasn't even gotten close. It's over 4,100 again today. It can't even go down and test 4K.
Yeah.
Because nobody, like the, well, I should say the market does not believe that the Fed will ever put itself in the economy in a position where everything breaks and everything gets destroyed. Mm-hmm. So for me, like, you know, we talked about the barbell approach that Parada used, you know, historically. After FTX, you know, we took losses there and we basically flipped everything to a DCA model and said, hey, you know, at that time it's November. The Bitcoin halving is roughly, what, 14, 15, 16 months away at that time. Now it's less than a year. Mm-hmm. Historically, that's a major catalyst. We don't know what's going to happen, but we need to move away from a market that has little to no yield at this point and into one where we slowly build exposure over time, understanding that we don't know when it will happen. We're never going to buy right before it pumps, but we know, but you know, we trust and our bet is basically one based on time that as this sorts itself out over the next 3 weeks, 3 months, you know, year, whatever, that it will sort it out and the market will return to normal conditions and that Bitcoin and Ethereum and crypto as a whole will be in the strongest position ever with a narrative around, you know, the banking crisis and banks being bad. Like, nobody likes banks, right? It's easy. So that's where we sit today. You know, it's tricky.
Well, everything you're saying right now is interesting, because on a micro level, obviously I'm dealing with NFTs and placing myself in that sector on a daily basis. Of course, I'm extremely bullish long-term on Web3 gaming and the ability to have assets with utility immediately. But the interesting dichotomy that exists today is that we sit in an environment like you were talking about with 50 ETH BAYC. It could potentially go down. It would get wrecked, you know, versus ETH and Bitcoin. All these different things exist. But at the same time, we're seeing Amazon launch an NFT marketplace in a month. And we see Starbucks NFT come out and launch their marketplace. And Reddit NFTs are at all-time highs when it comes to the amount of wallets being created, the volume. It's such an interesting dichotomy, because it's not happening in a bull market. Like, all of these products that are launching now or have launched in the last 6 months were formulated or ideated on in the bull and now are being created. And you're like, okay, this should be a really cool indicator for us. Amazon, fucking Amazon, is launching their NFT marketplace in a month, in the middle of the first bear market, or wherever we sit for NFTs. So
yeah,
that's the interesting stuff on the micro front for me, being in NFTs and seeing all this.
Yeah. I mean, it's you definitely want to see that, I think. I think without that, there would be that much more concern. I think that shows you that, like, the long-term viability of NFTs and the concept of digital collectibles and provenance and all these things, like, are very valuable. I think the difficulty on that micro level, again, is one where, like, crypto is an attention economy. Will those things be valuable to the crypto economy 6 months from now, or a year from now, or 18 months from now, or 24 months from now, right? Just like we've seen with DeFi. Crypto moves very quickly. Like, the only thing people care about right now is meme coins, you know. It's a tricky world to sit in. I think, like, the best thing is just to set out a plan, right? If you're still here, you're smart enough to be here, you haven't, like, gotten wrecked by the bear market, set out a plan, whether you want to only do NFTs, you only want to do coins, you want to do both, you only want to do DeFi, whatever it is. Like, you've got to have a plan that's based on objectivity and not the fact that, like, I just believe my bags are going to go up, because if they don't go up, then I'm wrecked. So, like, what, you know, I just, yep, that's just how your brain works, right? That's why this, you know, the psychological aspects of this are so difficult. So as long as you set out that plan, and every 3 months you look and you say, hey, what are the things that are confirming or denying that, like, this plan is right? And as long as those things haven't changed, then it's still a great time to be in NFTs or be in DeFi or be only in coins or whatever. But, you know, you got to stick to that plan. You've got to have a plan. And you have to put yourself in a position where you're going to get at least a taste of the next cycle and kind of what's going to be hot there.
Dropping knowledge consistently, man, over the last 5-6 years. I appreciate our time together in the space and obviously outside of it. I think I'm getting to Pittsburgh pretty soon, man. The lax season's, you know, finishing up this week. We've got a like a 2-week window that I want to try to work in a Pittsburgh trip. The Bucks are good this year.
Looks good.
20-12. I mean, that could turn around quick. Excited. But yeah. Kutch is back.
Yeah, everything, you know, feels good. It's the same kind of, like, bull market feel since the wild card game where they had, you know, it's like, hey, things are looking good. You ready to buy another jersey with the latest player or not?
Don't get me excited, man. Don't get me too excited, at least. Dude, it's been awesome. Thank you for again, being the guest here on the first episode of the Wild Wild Web. Folks, we appreciate you stopping by here on Spotify, and can't wait to continue, you know, pumping out these episodes. We'll have you back. Probably what, 2-3 months, maybe each quarter we have that Finch guy on to drop the alpha. So appreciate you, man.
Yeah, no doubt, man. Honored to be the first guest. You know, hopefully next time it's like December and we've been in a raging bull market and I come on with like chains and sunglasses and tell you I'm never selling.
Tell you about the tech.
Yeah, exactly. You know, tell you about the net, you know. some ZK AI meme coin clone or something that's going to the moon. So yeah, it's hang in there, everybody out there. You're gonna make it if you've made it at this point. I think you just you got to be patient. You got to be smart. Don't overtrade. Don't screw it up. And really pay attention to this banking narrative, because I think there's really something, there's something real there, it feels, to the point that, like, I think we could see frothy conditions again, sooner rather than later, relative to everybody's recession FUD and the Fed hiking to oblivion.
All right, that's going to be the end of the episode, because I can't stop on a more bullish sentiment than that. So thank you again, and I'll be talking to you soon, man.